Hello, and welcome to the 11th episode of Let's Talk Iran, providing Iranian-American perspectives on current events and policies that shape U.S.-Iran relations and affect the Iranian-American community. This program is brought to you by the National Iranian-American Council, otherwise known as NIAC. I'm Nobair Elmi, and I'll be your host. I'm here today with Ali Vaez, a fellow of science and technology and the director of the Iran Project at the Federation of American Scientists. He focuses on Iran's nuclear and missile programs, researching options for enhanced safeguards on Iran's nuclear activities, and advocating positive some diplomacy in resolving the standoff between Iran and the U.S. Ali was able to join us via telephone to discuss the recent report the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, released to the United Nations last week on Iran's nuclear program and the implications this has for U.S.-Iran relations. Ali, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what new information has the IAEA report revealed concerning Iran's nuclear program? I mean, were they able to show whether or not Iran is building a nuclear weapon?
I think the buzz surrounding the release of the new IAEA report was on par with the release of iPhone 4S, was anticipated to be a game changer, but actually failed to surprise. The report is unprecedented in the scale and scope of information available to the public, but it contains no new information, especially for the agency's member states. Most of the information included in the 12-page annex of the report was actually referenced to previous IAEA publications. You know, most analysts and pundits expected that the report would include evidence about elements of the nuclear program that were not shut down after 2003. But the report failed to meet this expectation, I think. What it actually tells us is that the scale and scope of the ongoing nuclear arms experiments pale in comparison with the pre-2003 efforts. The fact that Iran is seeking nuclear latency has been well known to the intelligence and non-proliferation communities for a long time. Both the 2007 U.S. National Intelligence Estimate and the 2009 IAEA report clearly stated this fact. So if you want, we all knew that there was gambling going on at the RICS. But the IAEA report simply highlights Iran's research and development efforts, which, by the way, does not readily translate to actual weaponization. But most importantly, this report, at least my reading of it, was that it showed Iran's progress on its nuclear arms experiments has been much milder than alarmists claim. And that's precisely the reason that I believe there is still time for diplomacy to resolve the Iranian nuclear issue.
So if the findings really weren't anything spectacular, like you said, the game changer that people were expecting, why was there all that buzz? What was the hype for?
Well, I would argue there were several reasons that we saw this report and at this time, and there was this hype surrounding it. First, it's the result of the deadlock that we have been experiencing in resolving this issue, as Iran has refused to answer IAEA questions and concerns regarding the alleged nuclear arms-related experiments since 2008. So I think the issue had reached its boiling point, and it just couldn't wait anymore. Second is that diplomatic negotiations between Iran and the P5 plus one countries have been in stalemate since January 2011, when talks in Istanbul ended in failure. And third, I suspect there has been a lot of pressure from Washington on the IAEA to bear more details on Iran's suspicious activities in order to pave the ground for more sanctions. You know, it has been 17 months since the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 1929 and imposed tough sanctions on Iran. And it seems that ratcheting up pressure on Iran has become an election year imperative in the U.S. And let's not forget that the report has emerged at a very sensitive time when tension between Washington and Tehran is at record high over the alleged plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington.
Well, you mentioned sanctions, so that's a perfect segue into the next question that I have for you. In Washington, you know, there has been talk of war, even tougher sanctions, and of diplomacy in dealing with Iran. What next steps should the Obama administration and Congress take towards Iran?
As you know, in theory, the U.S. has been pursuing a dual-track policy on Iran based on pressure and diplomacy. But in practice, the Iran policy has been long on sanctions and other coercive measures and short on concrete inducements. You know, we should not forget that since its inception, the Islamic Republic has been subject to a steady seam of sanctions. After more than three decades, I think the Iranian regime has come to master the art of skirting sanctions and has even learned to thrive in isolation. I think a good example to look at is that sanctions failed to preclude development of long-range missiles and advanced chemical and biological weapon capabilities in Iran. So they could come short of damping Iran's nuclear drive as well. So what should we do? You know, if this was easy, someone else had solved it a long time ago. But if I were to provide a set of recommendations to the U.S. policymakers, I would suggest a framework of five C's. The first C stands for confidence building. For years, the mantra of the IAEA has been to trust but verify. But because of years of concealment and prolonged diplomatic deadlock, there is an immense trust gap between Iran and the international community. And I believe there's no other way for Iran to bridge this gap other than coming clean on its past activities. However, to achieve such an outcome, the U.S. and the international community should provide Iran with guarantees that it will not be penalized for admitting to its past wrongdoings. And, you know, the same policy was implemented in the case of Libya, and it worked. And I see no reason why it shouldn't work with Iran. Washington, in return, should prove to Tehran that it's not seeking regime change under the guise of nuclear diplomacy. This can be done by removing some of the unilateral sanctions, which are not relevant to the nuclear program. And another thing that I think is important to take into account is that the current framework of negotiations with Iran should be changed, because the existing diplomatic construct requires Iran to put disproportionate trust in Western powers. And that's why I would suggest that the United Nations Security Council invite Turkey and Brazil, the two countries that initiated a potential diplomatic breakthrough with Iran in 2010, to officially join the P5 plus 1 and basically to create a P5 plus 3 framework, which increases the odds of reaching a compromise between Iran and the international community. The third C stands for carrots, or in other words, incentives. So if we want to persuade Iranian leaders to accept limits under nuclear programs, and to put it under rigorous international inspection, we should be able to offer them real and tangible incentives. The fourth C stands for codes of conduct. You know, both sides should submit to international rules and regulations in playing this game. One step, for example, would be to ratify the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, CTBT. On the Iranian side, this should actually be no problem, because the Iranian Supreme Leader issued a fatwa in 1995 against weapons of mass destruction. And the United States should also ratify the treaty to provide a good example to the world. I think another important step that the U.S. could take is to encourage Iran not to conflate its current dispute with the IAEA with ratification of nuclear safety and security conventions. You know, this is one of the things that I strongly believe in, that a special attention to the safety and security aspects of Iran's nuclear program, especially now in the aftermath of Japan's nuclear disaster, will enable Washington to adopt a less antagonizing tone towards the Iranian nuclear program. And it will also counter Tehran's denial of rights narrative. And the last C, which I think is the most important, stands for compromise. The compromise that the U.S. should do is to recognize Iran's right to enrichment. This, I think, should no longer be a taboo, because in 2009, the fuel swap deal that the U.S. was seeking was basically a de facto recognition of this right. But I think Washington should propose limits on Iran's nuclear program, which are realistic. For example, I would argue that one of these limits could be to cap the level of enrichment so that it doesn't go above 5%, and also to cap the volume, which I would say should be limited to Iran's actual fuel needs. So these are just some ideas out there that that could be used.
And unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I only have one last question for you. But Iran recently stated that it is still open to nuclear talks. So what steps are needed for such talks to occur, and what sort of incentives can the U.S. provide Iran? I know you just touched on a few, but if you can give any other examples, that would be great.
As you said, Tehran has already signaled its preparedness to stop enriching uranium at 20% level, and demonstrated also receptiveness to accepting enhanced safeguards on its nuclear activities. I think Washington should not let these opportunities go to waste. So instead of categorically dismissing these openings out of hand, which was, by the way, the modus operandi of the previous administration, the Obama administration should lever the heightened pressure to achieve diplomatic goals. And I strongly believe that that pressure without an open door doesn't work with Iran. And by open door, I mean a serious effort in diplomatic engagement and real inducements. One of the problems during the recent experience in negotiations with Iran was that, you know, while the punitive measures adopted against Iran were very clear and tangible, there has never been an offer of credible incentives to Iran. I would argue that in contrast to previous proposals by the international community, the incentives proposed to Iran should not be case-specific, meaning that allowing Iran to become a member of World Trade Organization or providing other economic incentives would set a precedent that could entice other nuclear aspiring countries to achieve their goals through the pursuit of dual-use technologies. Instead, as Iran argues that its peaceful nuclear program is for energy production, the incentives should solely target Iran's energy sector, which is facing monumental challenges. Mm-hmm. Take Iran's gas sector, for example. Despite having the second largest natural gas reserves in the world, Iran only ranks 26th among natural gas exporters. Over two-thirds of Iranian gas reserves are located in non-associated fields and remain completely untapped. I think only if Iran could capture and use the gas that it flares at the oil wells, it would support electrical generation projects equivalent of 4 nuclear reactors with 1,000 megawatt capacity per reactor. There are numerous options also available for renewable energy incentives. For instance, if Iran could develop its wind energy potential, it could produce 6 times more energy than the nuclear reactor in Bushehr. You know, I think instead of recycling the failed policies of the past, Washington should, first of all, define an Iranian nuclear program that it can live with, and then come up with real and tangible energy-related incentives to convince Iran to establish enhanced safeguards on its nuclear activities.
Well, Ali, thanks so much for speaking with us today. We appreciate hearing your analysis on the recent IAEA report and the possible implications on U.S.-Iran relations.
My pleasure.
You can follow Ali on Twitter at Ali Vaez, which is A-L-I-V-A-E-Z. And as always, please be sure to visit NIAC online at www.niacouncil.org.